30% of new clothes that are made will never be sold. 26 billion items of clothing. Making clothes that no one ever wears creates 2% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Truly, truly terrifying for stuff that no one ever buys, no one ever wears.
So many of us want change. So many of us dream about change, but we're not going to do anything about it. But this week's guest is Callie Russell, the CEO and co-founder of This Is Unfolded. He's on a mission after 10 years of being within the fashion industry in different guises, different companies that he has set up or different worlds that he has created, in seeing the extraordinary impact fashion makes on our lives. Fashion makes on this planet. Fashion makes to people across the globe. And his business, This Is Unfolded, is not your typical clothing brand. And you know what I like? I love new business ideas, a new model. And that's why I just had to have Callie on this podcast to really explain not only the stepping stones to get to this idea and to have an ability to pull different experiences, how we can fail, but we can learn so much at the same time to come to a point where we then have a shining beacon of light on a new idea that truly can change the world. Fashion has to change. The impact it's having on our planet is absolutely extraordinary. And we've got to do something by supporting brands like Zoe Calara, who founded We Are 8, a new social media platform. We need founders to take those issues, to get angry, and to do something about it. Because the world is wide open. There's consumers everywhere who's desperate for your vision. So this is a podcast to listen to when you want to actually make true impact, where you're not fearful of failing, you're fearful of not doing something about it. This is the one for you. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's Conversation of Inspiration. So welcome, Callie, to Conversations of Inspiration. It's such a pleasure to talk to you because this is going to be a conversation that's going to have a lot of ups and downs. I can see it already. Welcome. You're a man with a strong vision, a bold mission, even in the kitchen. You've turned down three dragons in the den, and there's probably not many people that can actually say that. So I'm looking forward to hearing the story. And I followed your story actually for quite a few years. And what you're doing is extraordinary in the fashion industry. But everyone knows that when we start this podcast, we're going to go back to little you, because we always somehow we learn so much from the little people that we used to be. And you grew up in rural Scotland, and I've been a bit panicked about if I'm going to actually pronounce anything correctly here. Very remote. Incredibly remote, but I'm going to let you tell me more about that. In Dunoon, is that right?
Yeah, so I'm actually originally from a village outside of Dunoon. So Dunoon is a town of about 10,000 people, which is about an hour and a half from Glasgow, which doesn't feel that remote and weirdly has some famous alumni. So the Labour leader, John Smith, was from Dunoon. The same sort of piece that comes through from it, and Brian Wilson and lots of George Robertson, who was the chair of NATO and stuff, all from little Dunoon, which is a very random thing. But I'm actually was born and brought up, sorry, I wasn't born, but I was brought up in a village about half an hour away from Dunoon. So if my mum and dad still live there, if I was to go to the nearest shop, that would be about an hour round trip to go and get milk or anything else that kind of comes through from that as well. So very, very remote.
Now that was called
that's where I was born. So Tillytoodlum is just outside Glasgow. So it's about 45 minutes from Glasgow. And Tillytoodlum has a very weird thing in the sense of it's a village called Tillytoodlum. The signs say Tillytoodlum.
Tell me that's in some Harry Potter feeling, isn't
it? So basically, Holly, that's fascinating. It's not in Harry Potter. And it's in reality, it's just a row of houses. It's actually, the village has a different name. but it was then in a book and it was called Tiddly Toodlum in the book, and the village just took the name. So all the signs now say Tiddly Toodlum. Oh. It basically changed its identity after being, I can't remember what the book is called, but after being in a book, the village decided, you know what, we're just going to be called what the name was in the book instead.
It sounds good, doesn't it, to live there? It sounds good to live there. So you were in, obviously, this ridiculously remote, an hour to go and get some milk. Now, how does that feel when you're a little one? Your mum, Kathleen, was a teacher and your father, Michael, was a politician. And so how did it feel to be so remote? Was it quite magical?
I don't know if I'd describe it as magical. It was a lot of fun. Like, so, you know, because there's lots of people kind of my age and the same sort of, well, not lots of people, but enough people my age. So you have a very different sort of like childhood or upbringing. So you spend a lot more time outside. You kind of, you know, you have a dog, you go on adventures with your dog, that you go and explore hills, you go and make forts, you know, you do all these sorts of different things. And that's an awful lot of fun. I think doing it now would be a lot more difficult than doing it then, because if I think back to when I was kind of like 15 or 16, that was like the age of you just getting a mobile phone, and where mobile phones became like kind of standards, like Nokia 3210, or I remember like the Philips Savvy. So like these huge things and you couldn't do anything with them. But for me to send a text message, because we, you know, live out in the countryside, I used to have to walk to the end of our drive, which would be about a quarter of a mile, to send a text message, and then you'd have to go back again. So, you know, if you're trying to like stay in contact with people, or, you know, chat to a girl or whatever it was quite a commitment, especially in Scottish winter. You'd have to put your jacket on, walk around the thing, send the text message, go
home,
wait half an hour, go back out again, and kind of move your way through that. So I think it was very different. And, you know, you rely a lot on, you know, like getting a lift and all these sort of things, but it's an awful lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Mm. And I think it's a great way for kids to kind of grow up and the funds of it and everything that kind of comes through to it. It's, you know, it's,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
lots of good things.
Absolutely. As I said, your parents were in these jobs of responsibility, being a teacher and a politician. Did you ever think, this looks like fun? I don't know. I don't know if a teacher or a politician when you're a child looks like fun.
Yeah, I don't know. If it's still, I don't know. Yeah.
No, did they make it fun at home?
Yeah. So my mum was a head teacher and had been for a long time. She was the head teacher of my primary school for a lot of time when I was a youngster, which I was quite funny. Your dad having to go to parents' evening to talk to your mum about how you were doing at school. I think that's always quite amusing. And yeah, my dad was a politician, so he worked away during the week and then came back at the weekends and stuff around that. I think I don't think I ever really wanted to go into any of those sorts of different paths. But what I found fascinating from it is that you're right, it's responsibility. It's, you know, putting yourself out there. It's being in front of people. Like, both of those roles in their own ways is a form of leading. It's a form of kind of encouraging. It's a form of trying to make the world a better place. And I think that's something that, you know, they probably distilled to me at quite a young age. And alongside that, probably also distilled that you have to work bloody hard. Like, whatever you do, you have to work really, really hard for that to kind of come through, whether that's, you know, my dad is a politician or my mum is as a head teacher. You know, even as a head teacher in a small community is a very connected role. Like, you know all the parents, you know all the same sort of things that kind of come through to it. It's not just a, you know, 9 till 4, 9 till 5 sort of job and then you get big summer holidays. It's like, you know, you are helping, you know, in the community, you're embracing that and everything that kind of comes through from it. I think that's a really important aspect, and I think it's something that, you know, is stuck with me all the way through life, whether it's a good thing, that sort of like work ethic and that kind of throw yourself into things or not. But it definitely was something that I knew of from a very young age and kind of embraced to a certain extent.
I think, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's different schools of thinking at the moment. And I do think grafting and hard work and that labor, the actual labor of building something and how long it takes to build something, whether it's a community or a reputation or a brand, it is a tireless amount of work that has to go into it. And I think that there is a notion, I think possibly from our social media and all these sorts of things, that things can happen quickly. And it is just a road to ruin, I would say. And we're going to talk about things happening too quickly and how it can ruin so many things. But before we get into that, I must say I smiled when looking at some of the things that you were looking to do. You know, you were given a small camera and told to film stuff. stuff that potentially made you want to think that you wanted to be an underwater cameraman. Mm. You had an ambition to be a doctor until you actually went to a G. Your,
my godfather.
I think it was your godfather.
My godfather's a GP.
Yeah, tell me about that.
So we do remember when you would do like work experiences, sorry, like school work experience where you'd go and do like, yes, a week or something. So in my fifth and sixth year, I did 2 weeks worth experience. So in 1 week, I got to be a BBC cameraman. So I thought I might, like when I was young, when I was very young, my dad ran a TV production company. So I used to spend like school holidays and in service days on kind of small TV sets. And I thought, this is quite good fun. This is quite interesting. So I thought I might want to be a cameraman. So I spent a week doing work experience with the BBC, where I just got to kind of go around and like, you know, video and, you know, interview people and lots of different things. It was a lot, it was an awful lot of fun. But it was a lot, it was kind of like a lot of sitting about, a lot of waiting sort of thing, kind of like pretty boring. It was quite good fun though. At the age of 15, I was on TV every day for a week across various different BBC shows, often just in the background of just being made to walk through the shots because the camera guys were quite
funny.
You
were an extra.
I was an extra, yeah. It was quite good fun. And then the next year, you know, I decided I didn't want to do that. So the next year I thought maybe I want to be a doctor. So my godfather's a GP. So he took me for a week and I went and did work experience with him. And after day three, I didn't go back. I was like, this is definitely not for me, because he just threw me into the deep end. Like he took me to he basically knew that I didn't want to do this and he was going to show me that I didn't want to do this. So he just gave
me... He was going to put you off 100%.
Like he took me to the most horrible things and like we did home visits and like all this sort of stuff. And he was just like, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. So it got to day three. So I was meant to do this for a week and obviously school week, 5 days. And I got to day three and he woke me up in the morning. He's like, do you want to come or do you want to just stay in the house? And I was like, I'm just going to stay in the house. Like, Jamie, I'm happy. I'm not doing this. This is not for me. You have won this. Let's leave it at that point and stuff like that. But I think that's like an amazing, some of my best friends are doctors now. It's like an amazing job. It's just, I just couldn't do it for that to
you
kind
just
of come
couldn't
through.
Do it.
Yeah.
But you, so these are the things that got ticked off. These were the no's, the crosses next to the boxes. Like, I'm not going to be an underwater cameraman. I'm not going to be that. I'm not going to be a doctor. But you joined Young Enterprise, the scheme. And God, that took me back when I was researching you, because I think I did as well. I can't remember quite what I did, but I remember absolutely loving it. And you sold placemats and coasters with some of your local scenery on them.
Yeah.
And you also became a local DJ.
Yeah. Really have taken me back. Yeah.
Tell me about those characteristics of what you, if you just quickly think about that, that you found in yourself to be able to do those things.
I think it's that sort of work sort of thing again, isn't it? It's like, you know, let's go and do this. Let's try to do something. I'm one of these people that will have an idea and will not realize that you probably can't do the idea. So we'll try the idea until I can make it work or can't make it work sort of idea. I often can't make it work, but hey, you go and give it a go anyway. So Young Enterprise, I think it's one of the most amazing things at schools. And I think it's something that we should make more kids should do, which was that in our final year. So I wasn't the best student, but I wasn't a bad student. And I'd kind of got myself into it. So in Scotland, we do like fifth year and sixth year at secondary school still. And I kind of have got the grades in fifth year that I can go to the universities that I'd want to go to. So my sixth year, because I was young, I was the youngest in my year, was a bit of a DOS year in the sense of I did classes that like, I'm going to get okay grades in these, but I don't need any grades in these.
Yeah.
And one of the classes that me and all of my friends did was business management, which was just like, was nothing really to do about business. It was like how to turn on a computer. If you really think back to it, it's just really awful. And one of my really quite smart friends actually failed, which still entertains me quite a lot. Like, how did you fail that? It was just the easiest class. But part of that and what we actually threw ourselves into was this course called Young Enterprise, which is just amazing, where they basically you start a company for like across your final year and you try to trade it and stuff. And we made placemats and coasters. Dunoon is a beautiful part of the world. Argyle, Cowell, it's very famous for that. So we got someone to gift us their images, which we then got put onto placemats and coasters. And then we sold those at local fairs, various different other things. We sold them to like local hotels. I will never forget. Yeah. And so much of, I think part of our stories could touch on is like, you know, when you try something and it fails and what you do after that. I will never forget the first place that we'd arranged to make our placemats and coasters had given us like the first set of them. And we took them to a local hotel to kind of sell, like try to do a big order sort of thing. And we put them down and they're like, oh yeah, maybe, yeah, we're quite interested. And then they put like a hot pan on top of it, like which would happen in the thing. And the whole thing melted. like in front of it. And we realized very quickly that our first supplier was not able to do what we needed them to do. And I remember skiving off one afternoon and just phoning suppliers across Scotland to find someone that could make me placemats and coasters at the price that we could do out of like our thing. And yeah. we found it and it worked really well. And yeah, I think that's an amazing organization that everyone should go and get involved in. And you can go and mentor and you can go and help out. And I think you should definitely go and do that. And then actually, yeah, my final year, I was 16 years old because I was the youngest in my year. And was I 16? I was maybe 17. I was underage. I definitely was not allowed in any bars or nightclubs.
I read it was you were 17.
I was 17. Yeah, I was 17.
You were out there, not necessarily legally.
Definitely illegally. 100% illegally. So I used to DJ a little bit in my spare time, and I DJed at someone's 18th birthday party in a bar. And the guy that owned the bar was then like, oh, we don't have anyone doing this every Friday and Saturday night. Do you want to just come and do it every Friday and Saturday night? And at no point did anyone ever ask me how old I was. And I used to get paid in cash and also a level of free alcohol. And I would go and pick up my wages in my school uniform on a Monday afternoon at lunchtime for that to kind of come through. And I used to do it every Friday and Saturday. And it was a great wee gig. And then from that, as the year went on, I ended up buying like a secondhand set of like speakers and like lights and stuff, which I would then hire out to people's parties at the weekend. So it ended up being this little kind of
so
like,
you had a side hustle as
little
well.
Side hustle, yeah. It worked.
A little side hustle as we thought, and we're going to talk about
it. It worked well.
Other words that you don't necessarily like as well, that all sort of, I think, were got born out of the pandemic.
Mm.
Just going back to your story, you went then to attend the University of Dundee before graduating and taking a job in the PR world. But it wasn't long before you decided you wanted to take your own path. And I mean, of course, I mean, you've already had about 3 or 4 gigs before the age of 17. And you started an online student magazine called Student Punch. Great name, by
it's
the way.
It's a good name, yeah.
Really good name. Which then led you to taking your first steps into your first online site recommended by. Go back, though, to Student Punch, what that was. And then why did that already? I mean, what age are you at this point in time?
And 21.
And 21. So 17. So we've already heard you've had a few gigs before your 17th birthday. You're now 21. You're doing your own magazine. What was the light bulb for recommended by?
So I worked all the way through uni. So I went to uni. I went to study economics.
Yeah.
I realized after the first month at studying economics that I had no real idea what economics was when I signed up to do economics.
Yeah.
And ended up doing politics. But I also worked all the way through. So I worked in Orange in a mobile phone shop. I used to work 12 hours a week and I'd outsell the people doing 40 hours a week that kind of come through. So I had a great time at university, commission, like really good fun. Like we had a really good crowd and I just learned how to sell to people, how to talk to people. I knew how to do that anyway, but I just kind of loved it and really embraced it. And then I went to PR and I did enjoy it. I graduated in the financial crash. I went to work for a really good firm. I did like 6 months and I was like, I'm just really bored. Like, this is just too samey. This is like too thing. And then that's what led me to decide to do, let's do the student magazine side of things. And really what I created there was a lifestyle business, which was I used to go to gigs 3 or 4 nights a week for free, interview bands, write content about it, and then get paid to sponsor that content from like financial organizations or supermarkets or that same sort of different angles. But it was never, ever going to be more than that. It was always just like, this is just like a nice sort of like, you're not going to make a great living from it. It'll just kind of stumble along. You'll do bits and pieces, but that's kind of it. And the realization on Recommended By was maybe we can try to build something bigger because you start to think about, right, well, what do these things look like? And the idea behind Recommended By was, could you make a recommendation platform where people could refer things to each other to get like a better deal or get a better offer through from it? In a nutshell, that sounds like quite a bad idea. Sorry, quite a good idea, but actually in principle, it's a bloody awful idea because people are really bad at actually telling other, like people are really good at organically telling people like, this is who my broadband with, this is who the same sort of thing with.
Yeah.
But if you try to incentivize it past that level, it makes it a lot worse. Secondly, on that as a business is my first like true example of outsourcing what I was building. And I worked with this like truly awful web development company. I mean, like they were just horrible. They were useless. They didn't deliver anything. Like it ended up, I think the final one, I went to their office with like a pretend legal letter to just get them to give me the source code. Cause I was like, this has just gone on too far. I'd lost all the money that I'd made on the student side of things. It was just a disaster from the get-go. And it just was never, it was a huge learning curve.
I mean, also, how old are you? Are you still
21, 22?
How are you literally meant to have gone through a pitch process and found your tech team? And you know what I mean? Like, it's probably someone who knew someone who knew someone.
Yeah.
And you thought, that's going to be a good idea. Yeah. And I think we've all been there, not in the high street when we started. I remember we didn't see the checkout until we stupidly built a microsite mm-hmm. that counted down the days. We didn't understand what a beta launch was. It didn't even, none of this language, this lingo didn't exist.
Yeah.
And it counted down the days, and we told every journalist, stupid of us, what it was. And it was something like day six to go, and the web team, you know, so can we see the actual, you know, the checkout, the actual checkout? And they couldn't build the checkout. There was no hope, no, never going to have a checkout. So we had to launch this online retailer as a preview site.
Wow.
I mean, what? And was just on the Daily Mail and things like that, those little publications.
Yeah.
So do you know what I mean? Like this startup thing, how can you do your due diligence when you really don't really know what the hell you're doing yourself?
And if you think about it, like when you started Not on the High Street, and you know, when I'm thinking about, you know, what I was building there and stuff, like there wasn't lots of other people that you could go to talk about this sort of stuff. Like there wasn't big ecosystems out there, or do you know what? It felt quite, you know, by my nature, sort of thing, like my sort of slightly small C conservative Scottish nature, like the idea of going out there and just emailing someone to be like, hi, could you help me? You don't know me, sort of thing. That wasn't there. That was there. So it kind of stops you doing that same sort of piece. So I think that's like one of the biggest learnings at these 6 points is that you can only learn by doing some of this stuff, and you will get it wrong, and these things happen, and you just have to kind of roll with it, learn from it, and just figure out what comes after that sort of point.
So you're coming over these obstacles, you're learning, you're getting more creative as you move on. So Recommended By doesn't work, basically. Yeah,
with a capital doesn't, Collie, with a capital doesn't. Like, I mean,
it fails. But in your case, though, and this is like, I'm just counting your businesses as we carry on through this podcast. In your case, the seeds have been sown, though, and what might have been setbacks for others, and we talk about that sort of entrepreneurial spirit, the DNA, what does it take? I think it is. It's just basically you don't have a fail button in your mind. You just, it's just a learning. It's a bump in the road, and you just move on to the next. So in your case, tell me about Malzy, which is the Tinder, what you're saying was called the Tinder for fashion.
Yeah, we were the first people to use that. Lots of other people have claimed that, but we were the very first people to use that. So what we did, so Recommend By wasn't going to work. So I decided that I was like, right, there's a better idea here. So we still kept the same company structure. And we decided that I'll sometimes flip between like I and we, and because there's different people who join me in different parts of the journey that we've been on. But I decided that, do you know what I'm going to do here is I'm going to try to build something else. So what I did was I created a single page website, which basically said we were going to build this like fashion aggregator. So like pull together all these fashion retailers into one single place because there should be a better way to do that. Didn't have any money to build it because I'd lost all my money on the Recommended By piece. So instead, I just made like a single page website and went out and promoted it the best I could, sort of thing. Like a little bit what you're talking about there. And from that, I got a friend who's a graphic designer to design some mock-ups of it.
Mm-hmm.
And which now you could have just probably done in Canva, if I'm being honest. And basically went out there and signed up. I think we signed up 3,500 people in about 6 weeks with like no marketing spend, no nothing, to this like concept of a website.
How are you signing them up in those days?
I think we were like emailing influencers or something, being like, hey, do you want to talk about this? And that's the sort of people. I can't fully remember, but we got lots. I'll never forget though, about 400 of those came from Iceland after someone in Iceland put us on their blog or talked about it or did something else that came through from it. And I did the maths, and I think something like 0.3% of the whole of Iceland signed up to this thing that didn't exist. For that to kind of came through. I remember saying that to an investor once, and they were like, what's that, like no percent of like Westminster? So obviously that same sort of idea. So we did this and it kind of got to that point. And then I used that And I managed to scrape a little bit of cash together to build like a beta version of that. And then from that, it gave us this position where I was able to say, well, look, I've been able to build something. I've been able to attract people to it with absolutely nothing. Like, that's a really good starting place to go to some investors. Mm-hmm. And we raised our very first like external capital. Then we raised like £80,000 from like four angel investors, which gave us a bit of time to work on this and refine it and build it through. But it gave us this starting point because we'd proven the two parts of like what you need for an internet mm-hmm. business, which is you need to be able to build something and then you need to be able to figure out distribution. Okay. And within that, there's a business model that still works because people are buying something or that bit that kind of comes through for where that sits.
And this was before its time, so to speak, wasn't
yeah.
it? This idea of pulling lots of brands together. You want to be able to filter by style preference. Yeah. You want to be able to steer, you know, what part of your life you've got different ways and different styles, and there wasn't anything that existed there.
Correct. Yeah.
Tell me about raising the money and what happened to this business, because this is you started, didn't you, your first den experience?
Yeah. So yeah, I've been on Dragon's Den twice now, which is really funny because actually last week.
Yeah. Is that even allowed?
Yeah, it is allowed. They will have me for a third time, I'm pretty sure, but definitely was allowed to do it twice because I got offered all the money both times and I said no both times. And I think I'm the only person that's ever happened to. And the reason why this is really funny just now is because like 2 weeks ago, one of my co-founders put in our Slack channel a video from The Chase.
Yeah.
And basically I was a question on The Chase because the question to the woman was, Kelly Russell has turned down the Dragons twice on what TV program? Sadly, she answered Game of Thrones, but I just quite love the idea that I've made it to the point of being a question on The Chase.
You even made it that your name was associated with Game of Thrones as well.
Oh, hey, I've made it. I can just stop now. Clearly, that's
you can
it.
Actually can stop. That's yeah, done. Finished.
Can't get any better than that.
When I first launched Holly & Co, it was my dream to put some fun back into the grey world of retail, but also to do it with a purpose, as a collective. I'm proud to unite the most talented UK makers and artists because we believe that together we can create a more thoughtful way to shop, live and work. So here's a little reminder of our promise to you. Firstly, we'll help you shop by your values. By curating thoughtfully made finds from innovative founders, we'll help you vote with your money for the kind of world you want to live in. Secondly, we'll inspire you in meaningful, thought-provoking ways, bringing fresh, creative ideas as well as unique gifts and homeware to every area of your life. And finally, we'll keep championing this community. You'll find that 95% of our small businesses are female-founded and 97% of our team are female. So we're run by women, made by women, but open to all. That's why we're passionate about inclusivity as well as about shining a light on creative independence across the UK. Sign up to our emails at holly.co to find out more. But for now, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. You went on to Dragon's Den
yep.
and you turned down all of the money.
Yep.
Tell me about that experience. That this was it in 2013?
Something like that, yeah. I think about that same sort of point. Yeah, so really what we'd built by that point is that we'd worked on this idea, a couple of us, me, two co-founders, Jamie and Callum, and a couple of other people, we'd worked on this idea where we'd built this like aggregator, like Tinder for fashion. We'd got it out there. We were getting like a decent number of downloads. So we were like, hey, let's go on like Dragon's Den. And yeah, we got an offer, which was an okay offer. But like, I think a lot of the times on these things is you have to remember this is like an entertainment show. It's not like an investment show. Like, so the valuations that you get offered, like these aren't really in line. And the thing around valuations and taking money from people and stuff is that, you know, hopefully that's the last money you ever have to take. But if it's not, you need to make sure that your cap table and your structure of your business is going to allow you to take other money in the future. And if you've sold 20% of your business for £75,000 to a dragon, chances are you're not raising any more money in the future because your cap table is now in such a structure that it makes it very difficult for anyone to interact with
yeah.
or for you to raise any more capital behind it. So we said no to that. And instead we raised, I think, £500,000 or £600,000 at a significantly higher valuation across the next... No, we said no to that and we raised 2.5 million instead. That's what we did. Like, that's different. So, yeah.
And also, I would say that that was the sort of era where Dragon's Den was not gamified as much, as in, like, maybe entrepreneurs didn't quite realize. Whereas now I feel like you know what you're doing when you go on Dragon's Den. Doesn't matter what's happening, what's being said. It's just great publicity. I'm sure it was then as well.
Yeah, it was great. And it's really helpful for that sort of stuff. I think the thing around this is, I think now we have to like understand that these things are like short, sharp shocks sort of thing. So like they happen and then that's it kind of like done. Or like you can reuse, like, you know, how do you use that content? How do you tell that story? And I think that sort of stuff is fascinating to kind of have all that kind of come together. And as I say, you know, doing it for a second time was definitely more nerve wracking. Maybe it's just because I had more gray hairs. So you have that slight more fear and stuff like that as well. And maybe I think they were meaner a second time around. Taker Suleiman was definitely meaner the second time around. He wasn't there the first time, but he was really mean the second time. And then offered me all the money, which is very amusing.
And so you went on, I mean, this is, you raised significant money. The app was downloaded millions of times. Yep. You had hundreds of high street shops listed on the site and it became a name on everyone's or every online shopper's lips. And then, am I right in saying COVID hit? Is this the moment where the shops closed and the fashion industry basically nosedived?
So really what we'd built with Malls was, in the end, like, fashion aggregators aren't really a thing, because the fundamental business model behind them doesn't really work. And what I mean by that is, if you're like a fashion aggregator trying to work with high street or brand name retailers, these guys are going to pay you between 6 and 10% commission if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. Okay. Some of them are going to try to pay you like 2% for existing customer purchases. Trying to build a business that you can acquire the scale of customers that you need on that margin, it's just impossible. Like, I see loads of aggregator businesses now. I see loads of sustainable aggregator businesses now. And people saying to me like, hey, list your product with us and we're going to charge you 20% commission. And I'm like, it's just not going to happen. Mm. Like, if you think about it, like if I look back on it, there's quite a few of us that were competing at all the same sort of time. I think only List are still going and they've raised tens of millions to get to that point. And they've ended up focusing very much on a significantly higher price point.
Yeah.
Most people who tried to do fashion aggregation, it didn't work. We realized quite early that business model wasn't going to work for us. So we moved our business that was like, hey, selling the clothes through the app is quite nice, but it's not where the money is going to be made. It's not going to be where we get scale. What we're going to do is we're going to take the data from behind it. So we built a data business, which we called Malsy Insights. We generated nearly 1 billion customer opinions on about 4 million products, predominantly in the UK. Mm-hmm. And we used that to build scoring algorithms, which we then went and worked with big retailers to help them predict what was going to sell and what wasn't going to sell. So we used to go into big retailers and say, hey, let us test your new collection. And we'll tell you that that's going to do well, that's going to do badly, that same sort of different idea. That's a great thing. And that's something that should happen in these businesses, because, like, fundamentally, a lot of these businesses are just absolutely chocked full with inefficiency.
Yeah.
Like, if you think for a second that, you know, the stats are terrifying, which is that 30% of new clothes that are made by big retailers will never be sold. Okay. 30%. This year, that will be 26 billion items of clothing that are made and never sold. If you kind of extrapolate that out and you think for a second and say, hey, the fashion industry creates about 9% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Mm. So making clothes that no one ever wears creates about 2% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Okay. That's terrifying. That's truly, truly terrifying for stuff that no one ever buys, no one ever wears. So what we did was we created this data offering and we sold it to these big retailers to say, hey, we can help you understand what to make and what not to make. And senior management in these companies love that. Like, if you think about it, it's like, see, like, you think about the ethics of it, but if you also think of the profit levels of it, that's fantastic. But, and this is the big but, and this is the thing where if you're starting a business or founding a business, is that you have to understand where, like, your crux points are. Like, what is the thing you have to overcome for that business to be successful? The thing that we had to overcome was basically the people that worked in these businesses and who made these decisions. Because we used to come in and be like, hey, your bosses have hired us to give you data to help you decide what to make and what not to make. And I would say like 30% of people would be like, great, give me the data, let's do a better job. Mm. And 70% of people would just say, no, it's my job. Like, it's my job to say what's going to make or what's not going to make. Like, you've worked in retail for a long time, Holly.
Yeah.
Like, you've met these people who you'll be like, that's not going to sell. The data says it's not going to sell. And then you'll turn your back. My favorite one of this one, it's a truly horrible story, but it just shows you the challenge of this, which is that, you know, we used to work for this supermarket group and we tested this t-shirt, and this t-shirt was like covered in bananas, right? So it's like covered in bananas, and the data comes back and says, the data says this is truly horrible. No one likes this. No one wants this. And then we leave and I come back 3 months later and they've bought 30,000 of them and they've sold 25% at full price. And it's like a £6 t-shirt. So if you're not selling it at full price, you're just not selling it. It's not happening.
Yeah.
And then you say, well, why did you buy that? The data told you not to do that. And they'll be like, oh, but last year I did one with oranges on it and it did really well. And you're just like, I can't win here. I can't change that mindset. I can't change that behavior without having, like, you could change that behavior, but it would take you like a generation and it would take so much money. And if you don't have that money, like, we raised a decent amount of money into that business. We raised about 8 million, but it's not enough to change a whole industry in terms of their behavior because the education, because of all the work that you have to go through from it. So we kind of got to an interesting place. We've got some really good clients.
And is this where, though, can I ask you, Kelly, is this where you're, because if you think about the journey, it's not necessarily did it come from an ethics place? You know, so I'm now seeing this coming through. You're now going from aggregating, you're understanding what this fashion industry is by dipping your toe into this, dipping your toe in a big way, into the sort of fashion world and watching what's happening. Then you go to Malsy and then you end up Malsy data, and you're now seeing it and you're hearing actually the, as you said, everyone's fearful of their jobs. And basically it doesn't matter what's going to go on with the planet because I'm going to keep in my job here that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Bananas are going to be what it is.
Yeah, I want the power. I want the control.
So tell me about this change within you that you were finding.
When you see those stats and you see the waste behind it, you can't, I think you've got to be a psychopath if you don't change, if you don't realize that you can't go on like this.
You can't unknow what you know, unknow, right? Yeah. That's one of the things that's always stuck with me, whether you like it or not, whether you don't want to actually know what you now know, you can't unknow what you know. And that's, it's a really interesting thing to hold on to if you're a listener, because maybe also the universe is trying to help you understand what your path is. Maybe you've been told something you don't want to know, but are you the person that's going to go and solve it? And I'm interested, Callie, this is building in you as the landfills are.
I think this is my kind of good and bad bit of me. Once I know that thing, I'll get it in my head. Well, if no one else is going to fix it, then I should fix that. And this is the kind of the issue that sits on it, which is like, if no one else is going to fix this, well, someone's got to do this about it. Like, this, I know this is a problem. If we just keep ignoring this, the real crux point though came was, I think I knew that I couldn't fix those businesses for about 2 years whilst I was still trying to fix them. And I couldn't get out of what I was doing. I was stuck. This is just the grind. And just that we could just push this a little bit further. And we should have just said, we can't fix these guys. We need to change. Like,
right.
But you're kind of sticking at it. You're keeping on pushing it. You're committed to it. I can't fix these guys. And then COVID came. And COVID was this like hard reset moment. And in the fashion industry, a couple of things happened. Everyone closed down all their stores. And we predominantly worked with store-based retailers because those are the guys that buy the most stock. They're the guys that buy it most in advance. They closed all their stores. Instantly, all of our money was made when people tested product. So instantly, if people aren't testing product, I'm making no money. Like, I literally have zero revenue all of a sudden. So you furlough some people out. You're kind of like, what are we going to do? Let's figure this out. And then you see this thing happening. I'll never forget it. I read this article on the BBC News website, which was a garment factory owner in Bangladesh talking about these big retailers cancelling their orders and refusing to pay for the orders that had already been produced. So they use like force majeure points in contracts to say, hey, I know you've made that. In some cases, it's in the UK. I'm not paying you for it. Okay, I'm cancelled. My stores are closed. I have no interest in helping you. So I read this article and there was a line that stuck out in it, which was, if COVID doesn't kill my workers, starvation will.
My God.
Because you have to remember, like, the vast majority of the clothes that we are wearing or we wear as consumers, they're not made here, right? They're made in other countries around the world. And some of those countries are entirely dependent upon our desire for these clothes. If you think about it, like Bangladesh is a country, 80% of their exports are ready-to-wear garments. 80% of a country of nearly 100 million people's exports are clothing. So when you have this rupture and this thing happening, it's crazy. But it happens at a point where the rest of the world is in utter meltdown. So none of us talk about it.
Yeah.
Like it's just like a small thing. Plus in reality, it's a huge thing. But we're all stuck in the house. We're all worried. We're all like nervous about these same sort of different things. So I saw this and I was like really angry and I was annoyed. And at this point in time, I was back in Colintrive. Like I managed to get there just before the lockdowns had happened. So I was kind of like there, just kind of staying at mum and dad's and kind of like figuring out what we wanted to do and this same sort of piece. And I had this rush of blood to the head, which was, I'm going to sell the clothes that had been cancelled by these big retailers so that there's money going to these garment workers, to these factory owners, so that it can keep that part of the thing going. So I had this idea. The people in the company that were not on furlough, we decided we're going to work on this for a little while. And we came up with this idea, which was that we would sell the clothes cancelled by big retailers as like a mystery box of clothes. And that every time someone bought a box, it would support a garment worker and her family through a charity in Bangladesh. And the idea was not to let retailers off the hook, but it was just to create cash flow to unlock that part of the process.
It's only you talking about this, and I'm so interested to hear about the lost stock, which is what it was called. We had so much going on at that point in time. And it's only now that we're uncovering so many industries and what was going on behind closed doors, mm-hmm. all the things you can't even imagine it touching upon. Never had I thought about that. You said £2 billion worth of stock orders leaving manufacturers
cancelled
with unwanted stock, unable to pay their workers. It's absolutely disgusting. I want to hear your story. And then I also want to ask, did anything ever happen? Did we ever find out about these people?
This is the thing. So on the lost stock point, so we basically, in the course of 3 weeks, we put together this idea where people would buy a mystery box of clothes and it would support a garment worker in Bangladesh on the other side of it. And we launched it. And the idea was, hey, if people want it, like we'll get some orders and then we'll figure out all the bits behind it. We had a bit of an idea around logistics. We'd spoken to some factories. We couldn't buy any stock. That's not how this was going to work. We said to people, hey, it'll take 6 to 8 weeks. You tell us your size, what colors you like, and then we'll try to match you against stuff that's been cancelled. The target, we were like, hey, if we could sell 10,000 of these, it becomes viable. And we were like, hey, if we could sell 10,000 in like a month or two, it's viable. It'll do what it needs to do and it'll do some good in the world. So we put it together. We launched it on a Monday. And by Wednesday night, we'd sold 10,000.
Wow.
And we'd just done like a couple of media interviews. And we'd got some influencers that we'd like just reached out to talk about it. And it just snowballed. Like it just went crazy. So in the end, we sold 115,000 boxes into 10 different countries around the world. And the money that we raised allowed us to support about 120,000 people for about a month each in Bangladesh, just from selling the clothes that had been cancelled by big brands and retailers as these mystery boxes, just from this like little idea that was like a rush of blood to the head. We got so many parts of it wrong. So many things were just broke in the side of the process. Turns out, Holly, building a global supply chain in the middle of a pandemic is a little bit difficult. Just a little bit difficult. You know what I mean? Like a little bit difficult for that to kind of
but
come
But the
out
vision from. Was there and it did help people. And this is the thing. It's just quite incredible. So you're going to say that when I was just... You knew what I was going to ask. None of those brands were held to account in these situations.
No, one of them threatened to sue me. That was quite good fun. I was really desperate for that, actually. I was really keen on one of them suing me because they're like, are you going to sell anything
Best
with our
PR.
Logo on it? Oh, 100%. I was like, please send me the cease and desist.
Well, this is what I was also going to ask. The logo, these must be people's brands.
Yeah.
So
it was basically, we sold stock that had been cancelled from 36 different brands in the end. We sold stock. We bought stock from 54 different factories across India and Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. Some brands were like really helpful and really nice, and obviously knew some people in those organizations because I had worked with some of them.
Yeah.
And I just went to them and said, hey, look, I know you've canceled the stock. And they're like, yeah, we feel horrible about it. And I was like, well, can you just tell me who all your suppliers are? Can you just give me your supplier list? Because I'm going to go buy it and I'm going to sell it. And they were totally fine about it. And they were actually, some of them were so helpful and they just wanted to do like amazing things.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the UK's biggest retailers who didn't cancel any stock, like were so helpful. Like they helped us with like advice on logistics, on CSR programs, and like were amazing.
Amazing.
There was one that was like, basically like, if you sell anything with my logo on it, I will sue you for everything that you've got, sort of piece. And they were like one of the biggest cancelers. In the first 7 days, I think like the British ambassador in Bangladesh had heard about what we were doing, because it was like in an article, because it went everywhere. Like it got loads of media. Like it was like, I think in the first 2 weeks, we'd have these situations where someone would get in touch, be like, hey, do you want to go on like drive time radio in New Zealand? And they were like, do you ship to New Zealand? And I'd just be like, yeah, we ship to New Zealand. Figure out how you ship to New Zealand. Like, I'm going to do that today. Start taking orders and we'll figure out how we ship to New Zealand like tomorrow for that to kind of come through to it. And just going through all these like different bits. It was just so surreal. And I think one of the things that I often say is like, I don't think any of us have really processed what happened during COVID. Like, I think there's like a lot of built up trauma and a lot of people from that time and everything that we went through from. And I know personally, and the reason why I say that is I know I haven't processed that all this happened. And as I say, there were so many of it was so amazing and it did so much good. Like it's, you know, I don't want to oversell it, but it saved people's lives. Like in countries where there is no safety net, it helped to provide a safety net. Okay. Like I think that's an amazing thing, but we got loads of parts of it wrong. And like, you got like people really angry because they didn't like their mystery box of clothes, like, or it took too long, or like, you know, what we had such, because we basically said like, it's £35 and you'll get like double the value of what you would have spent on the high street. You'll get £70 worth of clothes. And then people will be like, oh, well, I don't think this is £70 worth of clothes because this is this brand and the same sort of piece through for it. We got amazing PR from it at the start, and then we had like this bit of a backlash, and this like woman organized like a kind of a hate group sort of thing. She was like really angry and she made like a private Facebook group, and they had a mock trial for me. I went to my own mock trial. That was fun, where they had like all these questions and stuff. I'm like, it was such an amazing project. We got some amazing support from like big accountancy firms and like big legal firms, like just like one of the big accountancy, not top five, like I think one of RSM. Yeah. So one of like top accountancy firms like just gave us an accountant for 6 months because they were like, we just want to help. This is an amazing project. There's like accountant. So like everything was like audited. Everything was like managed through. And it was just like, it was just amazing to see how like conspiracy theories can happen on the internet and like everything else that kind of comes through from it.
And also, as you're trying to do good, this is about saving lives. And yet the main thing is, I don't like what's in my box, and let's do a mock trial and let's spend our time. I think quite a lot of odd things actually obviously happened during the pandemic, but I think there was a lot of built up. But I want to get into now, and what I want to really focus in on is your new business, This Is Unfolded, because this was another seed that created another oak tree. Do you feel like you've got to the place where you need to be?
Yeah, on a personal level, like definitely, and on a business level as well. So, you know, where we ended up with like lost stock was a thing that happened for a short period of time that traded on liquidity that had happened in the market because of COVID, and it did good with the proceeds from that. But you could only do it for, so we did that for 7 months. So we did 115,000 customers in 7 months from a standing start. So like, I basically didn't sleep for 7 months. Most of us didn't sleep. Like if you weren't doing your actual job, you spent the weekends doing like customer support and everything that kind of came through from it. And everyone who worked in that business over that period of time, like we just blood, sweat and tears. Do you know what I mean? Like that as well. And it was just so stressful and it was just constant. And then at the end of that, I was like, I can't go back and do what I was doing before with Malsy. I don't think it's going to work. I think I've thought that for a long time. What are we going to do? So we still had the same business structure. We decided that we're going to try something else. And then that's what Unfolded became. And really what it did was we ended up kind of shutting down the Malsy business and kind of finishing that off and stuff. That's taking a loss for investors and like my time on it and stuff. But you know, these things happen, you know, you kind of have to sometimes say goodbye to something and start afresh. And with Unfolded, we decided that instead of us trying to fix someone else's model, like this idea of like, let's keep asking brands to be better, mm-hmm. we decided now it's time just to build better brands.
Yeah, great.
Like you can't keep asking other people to fix their problems. You've just got to start from scratch and go from somewhere different. So with Unfolded, what we have created is we have created an entirely new way to make clothes. And the way that it works is that everything that we create has been designed in collaboration with our customers. So we started with 100 women helping us design the clothes. And for our most recent collection, about 7,500 helped design the products.
Wow.
So that's picking the colors, the prints, the shapes, everything that kind of comes through from that. What we then do is we use all of that input and all of that data to then decide to create a collection. We then launch a collection. And at the point of launching a collection, we don't actually have any stock. We have fabric like in production, but we haven't made anything. And what then happens is people order, and as they order, we then start production. So we try to match supply against demand, and we try to make clothes without the waste in the process. And we do that by taking all of customer feedback and customer input and kind of build that piece through. By doing it that way, number one, it's much better for the planet because you don't have all this overproduction. You're not moving stuff about the world. You're kind of tackling that bit through.
Mm.
But secondly, what you're doing is you're saving lots of money in the process. So if you think, if you're buying like a dress for £100 from like a high street retailer, chances are they haven't paid more than £20 for that dress. Like that's just the economies on it. But they have to charge £100 because they know they're not going to sell all of them, or they're going to have to sell like 40% of them at 50% off at the end of the season. Like that's just how their model is based. Our model is, well, we only make what people actually want. We've designed everything together. So instead of doing 100 different styles, we'll do 20. So we don't have that waste in it. So one, it can be better for the planet, but it also saves lots of money. And with the money that we save, we do three things. One, we do better quality for a great price. So like our most expensive dress in our recent collection is like £65. If you're going to go buy that dress somewhere else, it'd probably be between 90 and 120, depending on the brand. Secondly, we pay garment workers higher wages. So we have like a top-up fund for wages in India. So like that's where we produce. So we kind of pay bonus structure through that. And then thirdly, we basically fund education programs near our factories. So when we started, we asked our customers, like, what's the biggest impact you think you want to have in the world? And they were like, I want to help kids, okay? Because if we help kids, that sets kids off on a better way of life, mm-hmm. better opportunity, and bet that builds through. So if you buy a dress from me, then we will fund the kids to learn to read and write through an education program with an amazing organization in India near our factories for 2 months. And the whole idea behind this is that you tackle this thing that is so damaging for the planet, which is the waste of clothes, and you replace it with good in the world. And you do that in a way that's fun and interesting for everyone who wants to be part of it, because you get to be like a designer. Like you, when we do like a collection, our models are often our customers. We do like a customer photo shoot day where everyone gets to try on stuff and communicate that same sort of piece through. So this little idea of this little brand where we started with 100 customers back in 2021, 7,500 women designed the most recent collection. We're now at the point where hopefully this year we'll ship our 100,000th order just in the UK for that bit that kind of builds through from it. And what we're now doing is we're now opening up like the technology and everything that we have built to other people who have got communities to create their own brands with their community. So we have like a tall women's collection that is done with this online tall women's community. We worked with Fabulous Magazine to create a collection just for women with double D chests. And we're just about to do a new Christmas collection for them as well. And it's all done in this remove waste, do better for the world sort of approach.
So is this the sum of the parts? Because it feels like, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, did you meet manufacturers during lost stock?
Yeah.
The understanding of the impact and families and children. So there's another point there in your businesses, Morsi and Recommended By. You're looking at all of that waste. You're watching the behavior. You're looking at and actually at the same time, potentially, you're looking at consumers, and certainly during COVID, who did care. They gave a shit. Mm-hmm. They, you know, I think about what happened to the small business community, and so many people were awake at the wheel rather than being asleep at the wheel. You know, so many people were thinking about what they were eating, how they were treating their bodies, what they were buying, all of those things. Unfortunately, we're creatures of habit, and we go straight back to, you know, the other ways, because we're, our time and our energies are being pulled in so many directions. Did you feel like when you were coming up with this idea for Unfolded that there had been a reason why? I was just counting up from placemat time, nine types of businesses or side hustles that you've gone through to get to this point. Do you think it was all there to be a stepping stone and a ladder?
I think if I said yes, I'd be kind of pretending, and I'd be like connecting dots up that don't fully exist through from that. What I mean by that is I think Malsy into Lost Stock into what we're doing now, I'm still trying to fix the same problem. Mm. But I've just got angry enough now that I know that the people who have made the problem are not going to be the ones that fix it.
Right.
And it's me saying, well, do you know what? I've learned so much through all of that process that I'm going to use the knowledge that I gained from working with you to basically fix this problem myself on the other side of that. So I think from my perspective, looking at it like from that sort of angle, it's kind of it's like my MBA program. I've done my high school university, you know, and I've done my master's, and like, hey, I'm going to go back and do my MBA. And this is now me kind of going, this is the thing, you know, I think entrepreneurs, I think we can kind of say things that are sometimes a bit silly, but you know, I'm going to do it anyway, because why not? It's a podcast. If you can't say silly things on a podcast, then what's the point?
You?
Exactly. Do you know what I mean? Like that as well. This is the business that can genuinely change the world.
Yeah.
And this is, I think so many people, like you see like founders talk about, I'm going to change the world, I'm going to do this. And you're not, like, you're going to change like this little thing. Unfolded and what we're building, and like this idea of building this platform that can build us in lots of ways, this can genuinely change the world. Mm. If you think about it, we've not moved on. What we've had is you've got traditional fashion retail, you've got like fast fashion retail, you've now got super fast fashion retail.
Yeah.
You have to stand outside that and you have to say, no, there needs to be a better way. And that's what we're trying to do. Like, and we're not trying to do that in a way that I would consider like exclusive. And we're not trying to do that at a price point that excludes people from it. One of the things that always gets me around sustainable products is that so often you'll have this great sustainable product. It's got a great story, but it does all these amazing things. And you're like, people can't afford it. Mm. You're not going to drive real change with that product because it's such a niche product, because people aren't willing to pay that bit more into it. So you have to kind of figure out a better model to go and take on these guys in their own arena. You're going to get smashed a few times in the process of that, and you might not win, but if you do win, you create something that's genuinely like era defining. And that's what I think we're trying to build, which is to say, hey, we want to build like the place for people to go and shop like through one of these kind of micro brands with different communities or different groupings that can be sustainable, can be ethical, can be better for the planet, can do all these sorts of different things. My trade-off to you as a consumer is, hey, you just have to wait a little bit longer. Like if you're willing to order in August for your autumn winter stuff to arise in October, you can make it so it's better for the planet. You can make positive impact in the world. Mm. You can do all these sorts of things. We just have to get your mindset to shift a little bit into that same sort of bit.
Dell Technologies are passionate champions of small businesses. They recognize that it can be a lonely road, and so they have the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network, or DWEN for short, which is a worldwide community of over 100,000 female founders. They run free events and mentoring programs and have a network of brilliant women all connecting and sharing insight. They also recognize that for many small businesses, visibility is one of the biggest challenges they face when trying to reach new customers. So each week, Dell give away their ad break space. So now I'm going to hand over to this week's winner of Dell's independent ad break.
Are you ready to feel the magical well-being effects of journaling, but often find yourself feeling a bit stuck or uninspired when it comes to actually doing it? Or perhaps you found it hard to keep up the habit because your self-care always goes to the bottom of the priorities list. If this all sounds too familiar, I'm here to help. My name's Hannah Bevan, and I'm a journaling guide, writer, and the founder of Journal for Joy. Positive journaling has brought so many amazing benefits to my life. It has been absolutely transformative, actually. And perhaps it could be for you too. I truly believe it's my sole purpose to support and inspire people like you to find more joy and positivity through this simple but powerful practice. So I would love to be your guide. One of the best ways to journal with me is in my monthly membership, with live workshops on Zoom, weekly creative challenges, uplifting daily prompts, and a beautiful online community space, all for just $19.50 a month. And if you know someone else who might love this, I've got some great options for gifting the membership too. Head to my website, journalforjoy.co.uk, to discover more, or follow me on Instagram for lots more positivity and journaling inspiration.
Thank you, Del, for your support and generosity. If you'd like to find out more about Dwen and connect with brilliant and inspiring women, or you'd like to be in with a chance to have your very own ad break here on this series, head to holly.co/Del. Now, back to this week's conversation of inspiration.
When we think about what you were saying, that they were going faster and faster and faster, the thing is that then it went into super fast fashion.
Yeah.
So rather than actually everyone learning that something's got to change, it just sped up.
Yeah.
So actually more waste.
Yeah.
So actually how depressing that actually the opportunities of making new models, they chose to make faster models with more landfill,
yeah,
with more statistics. What are some of the other statistics about fast fashion?
So we do this when we go and ask people these questions on like Carnaby Street and like various different places to like guess fast fashion questions. I think one of my favorite one is like how much, like the waste one stands out as the biggest striker. It's the amount of stuff that goes to landfill. The fast fashion industry now makes more greenhouse gas emissions than France, Germany, and the UK combined every year.
My God.
The three huge industrialized countries, fast fashion industry makes more emissions. That's to kind of come through from it as well. Like, you kind of have to like understand that this is just an entirely broken model, like overproduction, waste, everything that sits within it. And the only way for us to fix this is no longer tweak. I think this, you know, the question that you asked me is like, is this like the final point or something? The way to fix this is no longer tweaking on the edges. It needs like a total reset, a total different setup into that process. And that's what we're trying to do. And the challenge of it is what we find, and just to be really open and honest about it as a business, is once I get someone to come and try Unfolded, like I know the chance that they will make a mindset shift and a position shift on it is quite significant. And they'll move to this model where they're like, hey, I'm going to buy like four times a year from your collections, and that's how I'm just going to do it now. And I'm going to turn off to this stuff over here. Mm-hmm. This kind of come through to it. And you're making an experience. So we talk a lot about how do you provide the dopamine hits that fast fashion has taught us all how to be. Well, you provide them with, hey, you're designing with us and you're seeing the stuff leave the factory. You're seeing all these sorts of different elements that kind of come together. So you're still getting all of those things that you're kind of hunting in terms of that dopamine, but you're doing it in a much better sort of way that kind of comes through to it.
Can I ask you, when you say the other way, so we're talking about fast fashion, but then, you know, I saw that you put a Meta ad out and it was rejected. And it was rejected based on the fact that you could influence public opinion, drawing attention to not causing the planet to die faster thanks to fast fashion. How is that even possible? And do you think, you know, because it's almost like it's a different way, isn't it? We need to eat a different way. We need to treat our bodies in a different way. We need to treat our minds in a different way. We need to buy in a different way. It is a re-education. And for those pioneering brands that actually take that on, to actually push something through, to become angry enough to do something literally about it, you're also up against the Meta world. You're also up against all of that.
So firstly on that one, like that has now been accepted. We took out three words from it and then it was accepted. So it's just fascinating to kind of see for that to kind of come through. These platforms so much own your way of connecting with customers and own your way of connecting with consumers. So you have to find ways to utilize them to kind of come through to it. If I'm being honest, like I've had a hard couple of weeks using these platforms, and that's like stressful because you're like, how do you get them to perform better? How do you kind of get them all to kind of come through together? I think this is the thing on it where if you're talking about like re-educating consumers, that's like a quite a terrifying thing. actually for us, we try not to think about it as fully re-educating them. I think it's just about giving them the opportunity to do something a little bit differently and like taking them on those little steps. Because I think so much, and what we need to be really careful of here is, if all consumers are over here and they're in their kind of like fast fashion, they're in their kind of like super fast fashion era, if you're trying to take them all and just be like, hey guys, you guys can now only shop on Vinted and everything needs to be secondhand, you will not move enough of them.
Yeah, that's kind exactly. of through.
So you have to find like these staging posts. And one of the things that we often like sometimes get is like, hey, like you shouldn't buy anything new. It's like comments on like an ad or like a social post. And you're like, most people aren't there. So you need to be these like steps in it. So we're like, we're not perfect. Like we still do things that like, we have things in our model that I don't love, but we have to make that sort of balance that allows it still to open it up to other people. Because if you don't have that balance, if you just end up with this final form of perfection, you will never take enough people with you to make that bit. Plus, if you take them with you step by step by step by step by step, hopefully you get there on the other side for her, that kind of comes through.
And what's your dream for Unfolded? Is it, what's your aspirations?
So the way that I look at this again is that I think what we're trying to build has a total place in this industry and a total place in this sector. Our vision of this is that we've built all this technology to power this model. And what we're now doing is we've now got Unfolded, which we will keep growing as a brand. And if you're listening to this podcast, please go and check out Unfolded and, you know, consider buying some of our clothes and joining our mission. But alongside that is that we'll open up that platform to people who have got communities and enable them to build brands in this way. And we will power the experience from them end to end. So I'm not just trying to build Unfolded as like a single business or a single brand into X size, because I don't think that works. I think that's very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. But I also think the other challenge of it is that I think you then end up falling into the same mistakes. You have more products, so you're trying to appeal to more people. I think you just need to appeal to a certain group of people and you stay narrow. And the way that you get that scale is by broadening that piece out. So our, like I kind of say it quite often, which is that the final vision point, and this is much further down the line, and you know, maybe we succeed, maybe we don't, is I want like 100 brands to operate in this, you know, better for the planet, zero waste, positive impact sort of way, all running on our platform. And for each of those brands to service a different community around the world. And some can be big, some can be small. But I think if we do that, the outsized impact that we can have in the world will be massive for that to kind of come through. And where we move that same sort of conversation and how all that kind of sets up. And really what we've been building is we've been building the building blocks to do this in this way, to set this up in this way, to build all this technology in this way. So, you know, we've got this like, returns is one of the most damaging things in the fashion industry. So we've built a peer-to-peer swapping platform where you can swap. If you get an item and you don't like the size or you don't like how it looks, you can swap with someone else in the community for free instead of returning it to us. So our return rate is like a third of the industry standard, because people go and do the swap bit, which again is good fun, it's a bit different, and again has that same sort of positive impact through from it.
It's just amazing. And tell me, for you, you've now, as I said, I've counted these businesses, all these,
please don't say the number again, that depressed me quite a lot, Holly.
Hang on a minute, don't panic here. We're talking about your placemats, yeah? If we were going to call my Monster Munch tuck shop that I built at school, that's not my third business. So I won't say that your businesses, right? But you're selling your DJing, and then you had your DJing side hustle here. I'm just saying nine moments, some much, much, much bigger. Thank you very much. For you, you've been Forbes 30 Under 30, in Dragon's Den, changing fashion industry for over a decade. You've got now this idea about 100 brands. And if you do 100 brands, you know, this is a really interesting point, because you could be touching so many different different points and different areas and different countries and different industries as well.
Yeah.
Tell me about your ambition, your drive. Is it going to stop anytime soon? Are you going to be like me, 90 years old and still working out why no one's actually built a coffin entrepreneurial company around death?
Like liquid death. Like what? If you can do it around water.
I mean, how big an industry do you think death is
huge, in terms of, you know? I can't believe
it's a big, big thing. And I always think about, you know, not on the high street. And I was like, not another funeral. And I was like, gosh, but it's just, everyone dies. Not sexy. Yeah. And Yeah, exactly. This is the thing. But are you going to be similar?
So do you know the Baz Luhrmann song about sunscreen?
I do indeed.
There's a line in that. If anyone hasn't listened to that song, go listen. It's a great song. It's a great 90s pop record. And there's a line in that which says, some of the most interesting 30-year-olds don't know what they want to do in life. The most interesting 40-year-olds, I don't know what to do in life. So I'm now between those two numbers. And I still don't think I know what I want to do in life. And I think I'll probably always be a little bit like that, which is, there's a big problem here. There's a problem that needs to be fixed. Let's go and fix that problem. And I think that's just somewhere deep inside me and what pushes it through. So what the future holds is, there's a big problem here. I think we've found a way to fix it. I think we've found a way that makes sense to fix it. I think we've found, like, we tried to fix it before, but we came up against an industry that doesn't want to change because it's too embedded, it's too set up. So what we've done is we've just gone round the side of that and said, we'll just build it ourselves. We'll go directly to the consumers. Let's go and get the consumers involved in it. If we get the consumers involved in it, you don't need the same sort of bit. It's easier to change their behavior than it is to change these brands' behavior. I think we've got a way to do that. Hopefully we can succeed. There's lots of challenges. Like these are capital intensive businesses. You know, you'll have known from your days at Nottingham High Street, getting in front of consumers is more and more expensive. It's more and more difficult getting those consumers to come back, all these same sort of different challenges. But hopefully we can do this because, one, from an economic standpoint, it's a worthwhile mission. But more importantly, from a societal and planetary standpoint, it has to happen. Like, we can't keep going on like this.
Yeah.
Like, this is the thing for, like, and I think what I find fascinating around this is that a lot of businesses that, you know, that are sustainable or ethical, I think so often of them, the size of the impact that they can have isn't big enough, and they get stuck in this smaller way of thinking. And we have to actually say, no, we have to take on some of these guys, and we have to go after a much bigger piece and everything else that kind of builds through from it.
Couldn't agree more. What a pleasure it's been to speak to you today. I end the podcast in a few ways, but before we get to your letter, I want to ask you, I intro'd you as basically everyone, hold on, we're going to go through a roller coaster of different parts of Callie's journey that have all accumulated to this amazing point with Unfolded. What would you say on that roller coaster has been one of your biggest lows?
I think that's a really hard question. So, like, there's been lots of them. Like, I think when we had a period of time with Lost Stock where, like, it was really hard to do, very stressful, none of us were sleeping, and you're having people like attack you for trying to do something that was like really genuinely good, and you were only doing something good. That was a really hard moment. I'll never forget, like, I ended up having to go on You and Yours on Channel 4, on Radio 4, which is like 800,000 listeners, for some of these people to attack me because they didn't like their box or it was too delayed or something like that as well.
God.
And I remember...
What is wrong with people?
I remember knowing that it was the segment before the news. So I knew that they wouldn't run past the news. So I was just like, I'm just going to speak for like, I'm not going to let anyone back in. Like, I'm just going to speak. And I remember like that happening, and it was really low doing it. And I was really stressed out. And then I remember it like happening. And it's like, from that, I think like 300 people went and bought boxes within the next 10 minutes who had heard it. I'm like, there, I'm going to go do this, and kind of through to it. The transition from Molesey to Unfolded was really difficult, was really hard, and like took a lot for me personally to do. Like, it's a really difficult thing to go through. I think if you're going to try to do this sort of stuff, I think if you're going to try to take on these sorts of challenges, and I still don't know if it's a good idea to take on these challenges, if I'm being honest, but I think if you're going to do them, you're going to have lots of really low points, okay? And you've just kind of got to find ways to not let them get to you too much. If I'm being honest, I think I probably had one for like the last 2 weeks. I'm like trying to figure out something around acquisition, and it's not working the way I want it to work. So you're like doing all these hours, you're trying all these sorts of different things, you're spending money, you're trying to do all these sorts of different things around from it. You've just got to find ways to get through it. And I think when you're young, I think you just buckle down and you keep going. That's how I think of things. The older I get, the more difficult those bits are to get through, because you feel them a bit more, you get more frustrated by them, and you just have to find ways to go do it. I will go for a run, take the dog for a walk, go and play five-a-side and kick someone for an hour. Like, those things will all help rebalance me relatively quickly that can come through from it.
Help the aging entrepreneur and the more frustration that we feel. Yeah. As I said, yeah, I totally agree. I'm 47 and I started, you know, at 27 at Nottingham High Street and building, and I now built Holly & Co. Do you know what I mean? It's tougher the second time round for sure. And the frustrations and the, yes, nothing's quick enough, nothing's, you know, all these sorts of things. Tell me about your high though.
During lockdown, and I don't think, again, I think it's the fact of like, I'm West Coast of Scotland, like we don't like to brag about what we've done or anything that kind of comes through from it. It's just not very much in our nature. During lockdown, something that I set up as a random idea with a couple of pals ended up supporting 120,000 people who had nothing. I don't think I could describe a better high than that. Mm. Like that's an amazing thing to have done. Out of utter chaos, out of all of this shit, we stood up and we fundamentally helped people who needed help at the point of true hardship for that to kind of come through.
And that no one else was going to help.
No one else was going to help. Not going to help in the way that we were going to help. Like other people tried to do different things, but like that's a massive, massive high. And it's something that I'm really... I don't think I'll ever forget. I don't think I've processed fully, but it's also something that I think is a pretty amazing achievement. And I'm really chuffed that we did. And I'm really chuffed that everyone who worked in that business got to be part of, you know, even with all the stresses that kind of went with it.
I'm going to hand over to you, Kelly, to your letter to your younger self. This has just been an amazing journey. I'm slightly exhausted by even... hearing it, let alone doing it. My goodness. I'm going to hand over to you now to share your thoughts and what you would say to your younger self.
Perfect. Well, firstly on this, just me doing this, it's a great thing. I love this as a concept, but I am, again, there's a 17-year-old boy screaming inside of me. What are you doing? What are you doing like writing letters to me at this point in time? But we'll give it a go, Holly. So apologies in advance if it's not as good or it's not as polished as some of the other ones that I've listened to and that kind of come through. So here we go. Dear Callie, you've got a hell of a journey ahead of you. So I thought I would share 7 things that I think will help you through the ups and downs. I wish I had known these things when I was your age. I might have been a lot further on my own journey if I had. I might not have also made some of the mistakes along the way or suffered as much. First up, follow your gut and back it up with data. Your biggest successes and best moments will come from listening to your gut and backing yourself. This might go against what others tell you, and many people will try and stop this sort of behavior, but this is often because they're fearful. You can't bend to them, or you won't get anywhere quickly, and you certainly won't achieve what you've set out to achieve. This might sound arrogant, it might go against what you've been taught, but trust me, it's the right advice. Secondly, mistakes happen. It's how you recover and learn from them that really matters. This might feel counterintuitive at the point they happen, but they can be good things. Fight the urge to let them get you down. Nothing good comes from this. Don't shy away from diving deep into a mistake after it happens to figure out what happened and how you can learn from it. Now, a biggie. Just keep going. Sadly, due to how you were raised and your natural optimism, you're never going to choose the easy path. You just weren't made that way. Resilience needs to be something you find, master it, own it, turn it into your superpower. Okay, 16-year-old you might hate the word superpower, but everyone has one, and the sooner that you accept yours, the better it'll be for everyone around you. But also, don't let this superpower stop you from walking away from something if you just can't make it work. The best people understand sometimes situations are impossible. Back yourself to succeed. Don't delude yourself in the process. You'll hear a lot of people talk about work-life balance. It's not something that you'll see a lot of at a young age. You're from a family of very hardworking people. People that are willing to sacrifice a lot for a vision and a cause. That's a powerful thing. Because of this, what most people think of as work-life balance won't be for you. You'll get bored, you'll get restless, and you just won't be able to accept it or feel fulfilled. That's okay. It's okay to be different. Instead, you need to find your own work-life balance. Find the level that works for you, and then respect the levels that other people need. Today, your work-life balance looks like spending time with loved ones, walking the dog every morning, and making sure you can play football at least once a week. That release is worth its weight in gold. Don't sacrifice it easily. Time is precious. So are your knees, by the way. It may not always feel like it, but it is. Make sure you take advantage of as much of it as possible. Don't waste time on things that don't matter to some aspect of your life. You won't get that time back. Certainly, don't waste time on things that you really don't want to do. You won't find any happiness there. Think bigger. Despite what others might tell you, and how they might try to dampen your spirit. Bigger is better. Bigger creates something that people can get behind and is how we really make a change in our world. Bigger is what gives energy and purpose to life. Bigger means even if you miss, you can still succeed. Bigger is what you're better at. Never forget that. Lean into it as much as you can. Finally, work as if you live in the early days of a better world. Okay, I've changed the quote a little bit, but this is important. It might be hard to believe that at this certain points, what you're doing in the world is actually making it better, but it will do. More people who work on things like this will make the world a better place. It will give you the energy to keep going and ensure you focus on the long-term mission. And finally, enjoy it. We all grace this planet for a relatively short time. Make sure you enjoy as much of it as you possibly can. Callie. P.S. Like all advice, what I've shared might be totally rubbish. Don't be afraid to go against it.
I just love that. I love that. I think of you in your in the snow on your driveway, standing there, running for your text message. And I think about the person that you were then, hearing that. And I just thank you for your energy. We need people like you, Kelly, who are going to fight our corner, because none of us want what's happening deep down. None of us do. And yet you're someone who's actually going to go and do something about it. And we thank you for your care, not only for the world, but for all of our souls as well today. And it's been such a pleasure to have you on this podcast.
Thanks for having me, Holly. Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe, and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.